From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, director Robert Altman talks with us about his new film, Vincent and Theo, about the relationship between Vincent van Gogh and his brother. Also today, a writer's worst nightmare of his number one fan. Kathy Bates talks with us about her role in the film Misery. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from the rap groups Guy and Levert. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new movie, The Russia House. It's part of our series in which our critics take a day off from their regular beat. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State James Baker says Soviet foreign policy is unlikely to change with the resignation of Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze. Baker told a Washington news conference that President Gorbachev has made a point of saying the Soviets will keep supporting the UN Security Council demand that Iraq withdraw from Kuwait. Barry Schweid has more from the State Department.
The resignation took the Bush administration by surprise, but by midday, Secretary of State James Baker was offering calm reassurances, although he said Shevardnadze's warning that Gorbachev is being pushed toward dictatorship should be taken seriously. Baker and other administration officials saluted Shevardnadze and his commitment to economic reform and to democratization. Baker said the two superpowers would keep working along the same path as they have in Shevardnadze's more than 5 years as foreign minister. The two big issues ahead are keeping pressure on Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait and concluding a treaty to reduce U.S. and Soviet long-range nuclear missiles. Shevardnadze is expected to stay on the job for at least a few weeks, and then, the Bush administration hopes, a like-minded successor will be chosen. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
The highest bishop of the U.S. Episcopal Church has appealed to President Bush to avoid the use of force in the Persian Gulf crisis. Presiding Bishop Edmund Browning met with the president today after returning from a trip to Baghdad. Browning said he didn't think a Mideast war would serve anyone's interests. Browning and 17 other U.S. religious leaders met with religious figures in Iraq. The bishop is the spiritual leader of 2.5 million Episcopalians in the United States. President Bush is a member of the Episcopal Church. Israel has reacted angrily to a United Nations Security Council vote condemning Israeli treatment of the Palestinians. Israeli officials say the resolution is one-sided. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Until the last minute, Israeli officials had hoped that the United States would veto any UN resolution condemning Israel for its treatment of the Palestinians. The resolution follows last October's violence in Jerusalem's Old City, in which Israeli border police shot and killed 18 Palestinians. But after weeks of negotiations and several postponements, the U.S. not only refused to veto the resolution, it voted in favor of it. A foreign ministry spokesman said the resolution doesn't contribute to calming the situation or advancing negotiations. The resolution could even be interpreted as encouraging violence, he said. But Israeli officials said they were somewhat relieved that an international peace conference was not mentioned as part of the resolution and only in a separate statement by the rotating president of the Security Council, Yemen. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 2 points today to close at 2,629.45. Declining issues led advances by nearly 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Film director Robert Altman has tried to bring some of the messiness and chaos of life into his movies. His films MASH, Nashville, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller broke new ground with their overlapping dialogue and scenes that grew out of improvisation. During much of the 70s, Altman was hailed as an American original, but by the end of that decade, he'd lost his popular following with the release of such films as Buffalo Bill and the Indians, A Wedding, and Health. 2 years ago, Altman gained wide critical acclaim for his cable TV series, Tanner 88. He joined forces with Doonesbury's Gary Trudeau to create a TV series for HBO that followed fictional candidate Jack Tanner as he ran for president in the 1988 Democratic primary. Now back on the widescreen, Altman is receiving rave reviews for his new film, Vincent and Theo, which is about painter Vincent van Gogh and his relationship with his brother Theo. Even though this is a biographical film, Altman says he didn't want to take on the responsibility of having to reflect historical truth.
I did not want to make one of those biographical films. I don't like those films, and I don't believe them. And I almost didn't make this picture because of that, because I think it's a big obligation to come out with a film about that has Vincent van Gogh in it, and people expect all adulation and profit. But I just try to set about my vision of this man and his brother as failed people, really.
Failed human
Not
beings?
As successful artists, failed human beings.
So what liberties did you decide it was okay to take with history, with the truth?
Well, we used most of the things that there are actual facts about, which, that he did cut Mutilady's ear a little bit, and then he shot himself, and there are certain dates where things were recorded. But you have to remember that at the time he lived, nobody had any inkling at all that he was going to be a successful anything. So people weren't running around, making notes on what happened. So the only evidence is hospital records and things like that. And then people who knew people who knew people. But
what about the letters?
I take the position that his letters were, most of them were works of art in themselves. They weren't, it's like his self-portraits. He didn't look like any of those self-portraits necessarily. He did maybe 400 self-portraits. But the letters, I think, are have their own purpose for the letter writer. And as far as getting evidence, factual evidence out of letters, only half of them were there. I mean, I have to assume that Theo wrote him once in a while. They didn't have any telephones.
You know, I'd never seen the 1956 Vincent Minnelli movie about Van Gogh, Lust for Life, so I ran out and rented it after I saw your movie. And
yeah.
I thought that it was really a study in contrast. You know, the Minnelli film has lots of dialogue. Everything is explained, both about Van Gogh's painting style and about his motivation. And Vincent Van Gogh, at least in the first half of the movie, is much more likable. He has more energy and enthusiasm. He's more vigorous and outgoing. In your movie, Vincent is remote. He's unreachable. He's joyless. He rarely speaks. He's physically unattractive, not in his bone structure, but he has food and dirt between his teeth. You can tell he probably smells and that he probably doesn't take care of himself physically. And he's driven to paint, but you don't know what's going on in his mind at all.
Well, I think he had a demon. I think like all artists have a demon, have demons. They have something compels them to do what they do, and it's very painful when it's not accepted. But that's the way he was. He was a beatnik, if you will. He rebelled against the social standards of his family and the. And, he came from, there was a very wealthy family he came from. His uncle was the admiral of the port of Amsterdam, and another uncle owned probably the largest, most successful art galleries in London and in Paris, the Goupils. And the other uncle was a bookseller, and they were all church people in the Dutch Reformed Church. They were pastors, and his father was a sort of a black sheep. He was a pastor of a small church in Holland, in Noonan, and a couple of other little towns. He just rebelled. He wouldn't eat in a restaurant if they had a tablecloth on the table, because he thought that was highfalutin. And that's the general information that we had, and that's the position that I took to show in the film.
Did you, in your own way, set out to do the opposite of the Minnelli movie? Did you see your film
I saw the Minnelli movie when it first came out. I'm sure. I just remember its existence. I don't remember any details of it, and I purposely didn't see it when I got ready to make this film. I just didn't want to be influenced pro or con by it, so I didn't deal with it.
I feel like in your portrayal, you've made Vincent van Gogh not only misunderstood, but kind of unlikable and very selfish. Was that your impression of him in reading about him?
Well, I think in the letters. I mean, I didn't study those letters, but I didn't read all of them, but every letter I've read somewhere, whether it's between the lines or actually on the page, in the letter is to Theo is, where's my money? Where's my allowance? Don't forget to send the cash. You know, and I think that that was a one reason for the letters. Letters are you know, one side of a debate. You put down, you write a letter. I write a letter, and I write the information I have to get across. But then, if I'm going to philosophize in the letter or talk about personal things, I'm talking about what I want the person who's reading that letter to believe. And I just don't trust I don't think that he sat down and purposely lied, but I think that those letters, I'd like to see Theo's letters, and had I had them, I might have had a different approach to the film. Were you offended, or did you object to the way that we portrayed Vincent?
Oh, it's not that I objected to it, and I know so little about Van Gogh's real life. I have no idea what's, like, historically faithful to the painter and what's not. I guess one thing I felt was perhaps missing was a sense of Vincent Van Gogh's internal life, because he's so remote. He's remote not only from the people, from the other characters in the film, from the people in his life, but I felt he was a little remote from me, that I didn't always have a sense of what went on in his mind, whether he was insane the whole time or whether he was just antisocial and self-involved. I thought perhaps with all the letters he left, there might have been a way to work in a little more of what his internal life was like, what his thoughts were like.
Well, I think his internal life was, that's the character I wanted to show. That's the character I wanted to show you, and that's the way we chose to do it. I mean, and my view, it's certainly not factual because nobody knows what the facts are.
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't very many people that know much about him. Everybody that wrote about him, other than his letters, Gauguin wrote some letters, Emile Bernard, there was some mention of him in letters, and he was just not a very likable man. But he was driven to the point and was extremely noble in that fact that he stayed at that for so long. And nobody, you must remember, nobody ever smiled at him. Nobody ever looked over his shoulder at what he was doing and said, oh, that's great. I'd like to take that home to my aunt or keep up the good work. I mean, he just didn't get any recognition and was dead and buried a long, long time before he did. And then the letters became, of course, a part of that. And the dramatic issues, incidences of his life. And then suddenly he's selling paintings. His last painting sold for $82 million. I mean, it's absurd.
Robert Altman is my guest. And in his new movie, Vincent and Theo, is about the Van Gogh brothers. I could say it like it sounds like a vaudeville team, you know?
Well, maybe they were.
I remember when I interviewed Keith Carradine earlier this year. He was telling me about his first his audition for you. And he said it was this, like, weird audition. You didn't have him do any scenes or anything. You looked at him. You spoke to him. And you hired him, if I remember the story correctly. How do you audition actors? And I should say this in the context that in your new movie, the stars of the film are actors who won't be known to most Americans.
Well, I hope they'll be known after the film.
Yeah.
Because Tim Roth and Paul Reese, all of them, the two boys are British actors, and then all the Dutch characters were played by Dutch actors speaking English, and all the French characters were played by French actors speaking English. And when I audition, I don't read scenes, have people read. I'm not, usually the kinds of films I make are not dependent on that the dialogue is not the most important part of what their obligation is. I try to get a feeling for the person themselves and what they seem capable of and how they approach a project or a character. And rarely have I had sat down and had someone read a scene for me. So Keith, I guess, was when I fired Keith from McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Keith Carradine, he came to see me, and I suppose he was a young actor then and just starting. I don't think he'd done very much. And he was used to going on interviews where they sat down and gave him a script and said, read this part. And I just didn't do that, so I think that probably stuck in his mind.
You know, I have this image of the director wanting to see how a camera sees an actor, how an actor looks on screen, which is often very different from how they look in real life. Can you see that in your head without having to actually shoot the person?
My eye, that's what I do. I mean, I kind of that's what my job is to be able to anticipate that. I've been wrong, but not very often. I mean, I know of actors that started and never worked. It was the same way Jeff Goldblum, Keith Carradine, Michael Murphy, Shelley Duvall, Cher. God, there's an endless number of people who have more or less started in films of mine, and I don't think there's any case where I actually read them. I just don't know how to do that.
Does an actor have to be a certain kind of actor to work with you?
Yeah, I think so. I have had times where I have worked with actors who I know are good actors. I mean, really good actors, because I've seen their work on film or on stage. I've seen what they can do, and I hire them, and this doesn't happen often, but it has happened. And suddenly I realize I'm talking to them, we're ready to do a scene, and I realize they don't understand, they're not getting it. We're on a different communication track. They don't understand what I'm saying, and they're frustrated, and they don't do well. And I don't know what to do about that. When that happens, it's just a shame, because it's as much my fault. It's not their fault. It's half their fault. But it's just, you know, we meet people in the course of our lives that we just don't connect with for some reason, and we can't explain it, but there's some reason we don't understand one another, and that happens occasionally.
I'm thinking too of do you feel you can work with an actor who likes to do lots and lots of takes and have a precise performance, something precise in their head? Because I know you like to do a lot of scenes that are part improvised, that are comparatively loose, and that just might not work with a character who wants to keep doing it till they get it just right.
Well, but the question is, what is just right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whose decision is what is just right? The most extreme example I've had of that, what you mentioned, was in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Warren Beatty is an actor who. He was wonderful in that film. I can't imagine anybody being better. But Warren he would still be doing takes if people would stay there and shoot it. He doesn't start rehearsing until the third or fourth take. You have to run film through the camera, and it's like putting his toe in the water, and then his foot, and then he's up to his thigh. He tests it until he finally gets very, very comfortable. Well, that's fine if you have the time and money to do that. But in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, most of the scenes he was doing, we were working with Julie Christie, who, on the contrary, likes to do it in one take, and she'll do another one. But you can actually see that she starts losing her concentration or her confidence as the repetition goes on. So I had a big problem. I mean, Warren kept getting better, and he does get better, and Julie kept losing it. So where do you stop?
So what'd you do?
Well, I stopped in what I always considered was the middle.
So probably nobody was happy, right?
Yeah, well, there was frustrations.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about making movies, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is film director Robert Altman. His new movie, Vincent and Theo, is about Vincent Van Gogh and his brother Theo. This is Fresh Air. Film director Robert Altman is my guest. Do you think of any of your movies as artistic failures? Are there any that you've made that you're unhappy with looking back?
No. And I say that because it's kind of arrogant, but I don't have the only film that I don't recommend to someone who has some that thinks they may want to see it. I did a portion of a film called Aria. A bunch of film directors did little opera, I guess opera videos, and they were put together, and I did mine, and I what I did was all right. But the way the whole piece was put together, I thought was, I'm sorry I did it. But all the other films are exactly what we set out, we meaning the collaborative artists that were involved in it. They're all what we set out to do, and whether a thing works commercially or not really doesn't have much to do with it. I mean, that's a matter of luck, time. There's certain films I've made that have failed at the box office and failed with the critics, and I understand why. But some of those same films have a cult following, and there's people who love them. Timing has a lot to do with it. We made Buffalo Bill and the Indians with Paul Newman. It just came out at a time. I think it's a wonderful film, and we won the Berlin Film Festival. We got a lot of accolades on it, but the audience, American audience, didn't like it very much, and just didn't go see it because we were spoofing an American hero. It was a rather hard look at it, and actually what we were satirizing was show business itself. But that came out at the bicentennial year when Nixon had just resigned, and nobody in America felt very good about themselves. Because most of them had voted for Nixon, and they felt like they're the ones that had been caught and been made a fool of, as indeed they had. So they weren't much thrilled when we came out on July 4th on the bicentennial day and said, come and look at another American hero that we're laughing at.
I know you were living in Paris for a few years.
Yes.
Are you still there, or have you moved back to the States?
I have a car with a telephone in Paris, and I've given up my apartment. I'm back here now. I may go back to Europe, but I don't own any. I don't keep a house there or anything. My office is in New York, and I have an apartment in New York, and I have a little apartment out here in California, and I kind of split my time between the two.
So what does moving back to the States signify?
Nothing. It's just I fiddle on the corner where they throw the coins. It's where I can get a job.
Does it mean you're able to get more work in the States now than you were before?
No, I'm not doing very well at all, which is why I'll probably go back to Europe. It seems it's a lot easier for me to work in Europe than here. There's a different attitude. It's not blatantly as commercial or openly as commercial here. Here, all the films that people want to make are films that are to serve an existing marketplace. That's why you see all the numbers after the titles, 2, 3, 4, 6, sequels, because everybody's trying to find what it is that people want to see and give it. And I think that in an artistic medium, if there is any art left in this, the artist should do something, and then it should be exposed, and people either respond to it or they don't. But I think we've made too much of a business out of it. I don't think the audience now generally gets a true someone's true feelings or inspiration about a subject, and in most cases it's tested, and they say, oh, they like this kind of an ending, they don't like that kind of an ending, and I can't really concern myself about what it is, what kind of an ending it likes. You seem to show some disappointment or dissatisfaction in the way I presented Vincent. Because he wasn't made to be attractive, or I didn't show you what went on inside of his mind. Well, this is the way I chose to show it. Many people, And you're not wrong, and I'm not wrong. That this is just what this is. Many people have quite the opposite reading on it. Mostly artists, for instance, people who do paint and who make their living at it, in that business. Most of them are really feel this film is an accomplishment, and I'm thrilled with that. Other people have the feeling that you have when they say, "Oh well, it wasn't. It was that he wasn't a." I didn't learn enough about him, and I wasn't trying to do. It wasn't a training film. You understand?
Right. Yeah.
But that's not to say that you're wrong, or I mean, I made a film called Quintet with Paul Newman that nobody liked. I mean, it was really a failure. That picture lost money, not a lot, but it did. And yet in Europe and in the United States, there are little cult groups that just, that's the movie. So, and as long as I can find that cult, and a cult, you understand, is not enough people to make a minority, that pleases me, because that's what I'm trying to do, is just show, hey, look at it this way. This may not be the truth, this may not be, but this is the way it appears to me.
In 1988, you did a series for cable called Tanner 88, and you had your own candidate, played by Michael Murphy, who went to all the places of the primary elections and campaigned, and there were real consultants who who consulted with him on camera.
Yeah.
Do you have a sequel planned?
Well, we're talking to Tanner about running in 1992. Gary Trudeau is my partner in this, And we're willing. We'd like to run Jack again. We're trying to encourage him to want to run. I just don't know that we're going to get enough. You know, we need some campaign contributions. And Jack is a very funny guy. He wouldn't take any money the last time from Keating and those people. So we may not get it. But chances are we'll be running Tanner in 92. I think that we need to.
Robert Altman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing the interview. My guest has been film director Robert Altman. His new movie is Vincent and Theo, about Vincent van Gogh and his brother Theo. Next time, writer Salman Rushdie speaks to us by phone from hiding. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the film Misery, Kathy Bates plays the world's most obsessive fan, and James Caan plays the author who's the unfortunate object of her obsession. Coming up, Kathy Bates tells us about the scene in Misery that we'd just as soon forget. Also, Rock Critic Kentucky reviews two new albums in the style known as New Jack Swing. And we begin a series in which we let our critics trade places with each other. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new film, The Russia House. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze told a shocked Soviet parliament today that he is stepping aside, and he defended his foreign policy moves, denying that he planned to send Soviet troops to the Persian Gulf. In Washington, the Bush administration shares some of the concern the foreign minister indicated about rising conservatism inside the Soviet Union. But U.S. officials said, for the record at least, that they do not expect Soviet foreign policy to change. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Secretary of State James Baker had this reaction to Shevardnadze's claim that dictatorship could return to the Soviet Union.
We would obviously be foolish, I think, not to take the warning in Minister Shevardnadze's resignation statement seriously.
Baker said that U.S. economic assistance to the Soviet Union depends on continued reform efforts there. He said for now, those economic aid programs are likely to go forward. As for Moscow's foreign policy,
we have no reason whatsoever to doubt President Gorbachev's statement that Soviet foreign policy will not change.
But some analysts disagree, because Shevardnadze was such a forceful advocate for cooperating with the United States in the Persian Gulf and elsewhere. There are doubts that that level of cooperation can be sustained with Shevardnadze no longer on the scene. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
West European leaders today heaped praise on Shevardnadze for having advanced the cause of European integration and unity. But several also said that his departure is a cause for concern. And they called on countries to increase their support for Soviet leader Gorbachev's reform efforts. More from NPR's Tom Gelton in Berlin.
German Chancellor Helmut Kohl and his foreign minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher heard about Shevardnadze's resignation as they sat in the first meeting of the newly elected all-German parliament. Both worked closely with Shevardnadze as they negotiated the terms of German unification and the end of Allied occupation rights here, and both expressed regret at the news of his departure. Kohl said he would greatly miss Shevardnadze. Genscher said it was more important than ever now for Western supporters of perestroika to come to the aid of reform forces in the Soviet Union. The French foreign minister, Roland Dumas, echoed that sentiment, saying Shevardnadze's speech was a cry of alarm that should be heeded by all those who have been dragging their feet in helping Gorbachev. The European community said it was worried by Shevardnadze's resignation, and the NATO Allied Command warned that the Soviet Union must be careful now to maintain order without sacrificing democratic principles. I'm Tom Chelton in Berlin.
And in New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 3 points to close today at 2,629.46 on volume of some 175 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, we meet Kathy Bates, co-star of the movie Misery. The musical groups Guy and Levert are both trios, both blend hip-hop and ballads, and both have new albums. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of them. From Guy, here's D.O.G. Me Out.
Although Teddy Riley has barely dented the consciousness of the white pop world, he's probably the most innovative producer of the past decade. Both on his own and with his group Guy, Riley creates a sound he calls New Jack Swing that features sharp, hammering percussion, jittery keyboard rhythms, and lyrics that are alternately rapped and crooned. The result is a singularly energetic, spunky sound.
You please. I'll do anything.
Come on, man.
In the world.
Riley has produced big hit singles in recent years for Bobby Brown, rapper Kool Moe Dee, and the gospel group The Winans. And New Jack Swing is being copied all over the place, most prominently these days on Whitney Houston's number one hit, I'm Your Baby Tonight. But Riley is already looking past New Jack Swing to another pop synthesis. In recent interviews, he's talked about reaching back to 60s soul music and revitalizing that for the 90s. You can hear some of this ambition in the album's title song, which features music that might remind you of some of Marvin Gaye's or Stevie Wonder's dreamier material. Brothers, sisters, where Guy's album is a unified piece of work, Levert's album, Ropadope Style, is pleasingly schizophrenic. This is another trio, brothers Gerald and Sean Levert plus Mark Gordon. They alternate between sexy funk grooves and romantic ballads. These two styles derive from a pair of profound influences. Gerald and Sean are the sons of Eddie Levert, a founding member of the Philly soul masters The OJs. The ballads here owe a lot to The OJs' style of tough but tender singing.
Baby, I know that you need morning, noon, and evening love. And I just ain't been giving you my time. But girl, I wanna give you every little piece, every little part of me. Show you my love, just can't be beat. No, baby, I'm ready.
By contrast, Levert's funk style suggests a thorough knowledge not only of the latest New Jack Swing developments, but also the 70s work of acts like The Gap Band and George Clinton's Parliament Funkadelic. Levert's Ropadope Style, for example, employs the easy chugging rhythm of Clinton's decade-old song, Pump It Up.
Like that, y'all.
There's no one in Levert with the overarching vision of a new pop future that Teddy Riley seems to possess. Still, taken together, both of these young groups speak well for ongoing innovation in the rhythm and blues of the 90s.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Nobody does it better than me.
You feel the world is getting you down. Call on me. I'm the one you need to see. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Remember that there'll be a better day. You let nothing stand in your way. And remember these four words I have to say.
This is Fresh Air. In the thriller Misery, Kathy Bates plays Annie Wilkes, a registered nurse and an obsessive fan of romance novelist Paul Sheldon, played by James Caan. It's the first major movie role for Bates. Her previous work has been on the stage in such plays as Night Mother, Frankie and Johnny and the Clair de Lune, and Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean. Misery opens as Paul Sheldon finishes a new novel in the quiet of a remote Colorado cabin. On the drive home, he gets caught in a blizzard and drives off the road. The unconscious rider is rescued by the nurse, played by Bates, who turns out to be his number one fan. Too bad she's also crazy. She nurses him back to health, and she creates makeshift casts for his two broken legs, but she keeps him as her prisoner. And as he begins to heal, she makes sure he stays disabled. This is a clip from the most revolting scene in the movie, the sledgehammer scene. Even if you haven't seen the film, you'll remember this from the TV ads. But the ad ends before we actually see how Annie hurts Paul.
I know you've been out twice, Paul. First, I couldn't figure out how you did it. But last night, I found your key. I know I left my scrapbook out. I can imagine what you might be thinking of me. But you see, Paul, it's all okay. Last night, it came so clear. I realize you just need more time. Eventually, you'll come to accept the idea of being here. Paul, do you know about the early days at the Kimberly Diamond Mines? Do you know what they did to the native workers who stole diamonds? Don't worry, they didn't kill them. That would be like junking a Mercedes just because it had a broken spring. No, if they caught them, they had to make sure they could go on working, but they also had to make sure they could never run away. The operation was called hobbling.
Annie, whatever you're thinking about doing, please don't do it. Annie, for God's...
Shh, darling. Trust me.
Do you want to explain what you do in this scene?
Technically, I put a board between his legs and I break his ankles.
You know, it's such a... This is the scene that you walk away thinking, oh gosh, I hope I don't think about this scene very often. It really hurts to watch it.
Yeah, my sister, who's had a problem with her ankle, said it was particularly difficult for her.
What did you actually hit?
I actually hit a prosthetic leg that was built for us by the special effects team, KNB. And they built a couple of really very realistic legs that we used in that particular shot.
Did this image haunt you?
No, it was more of a technical problem for me, Terry, and I think it was more of a difficult shot in terms of camera angles, and so by the time we'd gone through it several times, that was what I was more interested in, was trying to get it right than anything else.
What was your reaction when the first time you saw it on screen?
I thought it looked great. I couldn't believe it worked so well.
Have people been telling you that this film relates to... Have well-known people been telling you that this film relates to phobias they have about their own fans?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. Rob Reiner told me that Ringo Starr had come to one of the early screenings and liked the film very much, and afterwards went outside and was walking, I guess, to the car with friends, and some woman came up to him on the street who completely out of the blue and said, "Oh, are you Ringo Starr?" And he said, "Yes." She said, "I'm your number one fan." And he just turned white, apparently. I think that was the wrong time for him to hear that.
Well, everybody's probably been coming up to you and saying they're your number one fan.
Yes, they are. I was on The Tonight Show last night, and I said it to Barry Manilow just to be mean.
And I understand that you studied tapes of psychopathic killers before doing the role.
Yes.
What did you look
actually
at?
I read some books, and I did see some tapes of nurses who kill.
Where did you find the tape?
Well, quite by accident. Right after I was cast in the role, I saw a program on Geraldo Rivera, and they had a program on nurses who kill. I thought there was only one or two, but there are quite a few out there, apparently. And
it's like a theme show made for you.
Yeah, and these were male nurses, actually. The chilling thing about these portraits was that the individuals who were in prison for committing these crimes were extremely disconnected to the event itself. And one of them, I remember saying, well, I know I must have done it because I'm in jail. But he had no connection to what he had done at all. And I liked that disconnection. And going back to your first question, I think emotionally that's what's happening with Annie during the hobbling. There's just absolutely no real connection to the event and the pain that she's causing this other human being. And I think that's a central characteristic of a psychopath, a sociopath.
This was really your first big movie role. How are you cast in the role?
I was handed it by Mr. Rob Reiner. He had seen my work out in L.A. as a stage actor, and he called and said that he was interested in hiring me to do the lead in his new film. And I was thrilled when I heard it was going to be Misery, because it was a book that I had read some years ago, and I'd always secretly wanted to play the character of Annie.
Do you think that not being glamorous and being what would be considered slightly overweight by conventional standards has stood in your way in terms of your movie career?
I'm sure it's kept me from getting roles that, I might have wanted to get, and because people don't look at women, let me rephrase that. I think definitely Hollywood and Madison Avenue have pigeonholed women's physical traits into a certain narrow area, which lets a lot of us out of the room there, and that's something that's always bothered me. It's not something that I've always wanted to bend my my shape to fit their desires. I'm hoping that things will change, that people will start casting people because they're good actors. Maybe I'm being really naive, even at the age of 42, but I keep hoping that it'll change.
Well, it's funny, even one of the roles that you played on stage in Night Mother went to a beautiful, very slender actress, Sissy Spacek, in the movie.
Yes. Well, the role originally was written for an anorexic 45-year-old. And then I played the role, and it's interesting. I remember there was a theater in Texas that was advertising for casting for the role, and advertised it should be 30s and overweight. So, I mean, go figure. I don't know why. I often get asked this question, especially by male interviewers, about my weight and about rejection and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's so interesting that I probably wouldn't be discussing this if I wasn't a woman. I'm not sure exactly why that has to be, but it certainly is reality for me.
Well, I'll tell you, though, it's been my observation that most of the character roles and people who don't have the conventional looks, male or female, usually end up as character actors in movies. I mean, that's just the reality of it. But most of the really good character roles are male roles. And I find that there's very few really good character roles for women. And it seems that most of the women who really make it in movies are the ones who look right, who have the fashion model kind of looks.
Right, that's true. I wish that there were, my heroes, people always ask me, who were your favorite, actors when you were growing up? It was those male character actors like Lee J. Cobb, and Spencer Tracy, and people who had some weight to them, people who not just physically, but they had a center, they were plugged in. That was the kind of image that I was interested in, and I would like for that to change for women in film and in television. I mean, I don't think women have to go around, everybody, whenever you start talking like this, men always say, oh, okay, everybody has to look like a slob. That's not what I mean. I just, I think there just needs to be more open-mindedness and appreciate women for who they are instead of what they're trying to become.
Well, I think women who go to movies feel that way, too, because I always feel like I can never find myself on screen,
Yeah, I know. It's daunting.
I can't relate to these fashion model looks.
I remember going to see a movie, I guess it was Tom Cruise's movie, Cocktail. I was sitting next to two teenage girls, and the minute the ingenue came on screen, she hadn't been on screen a half a second when they said, she's fat. Now, here was this girl who was not fat. You know, I mean, it was really scary. I was thinking, my God, what is this, you know, perception going on here? And it, here it has started there at, what, at 13, 14 years old. You know, how is their judgment going to affect their lives personally? Right now, they're projecting it onto somebody else on screen. But how is that projection going to affect their psyche and their physical nature?
How did you start your stage career?
I started doing some plays in high school, and then I studied acting in at college, and then I went to New York in 1970 and tried it with everybody else, and began to do work off Broadway there, and then off Broadway, and finally Broadway, and did some regional theater around the country. It's difficult to get started in the business nowadays because fewer plays are being done in New York, and it's hard for kids to come to New York and find a way to showcase their talents without having to be in the unions, and so it's a difficult business now. It was a little easier back when I started.
I have one bone to pick with the, this isn't with the acting, but with the characterization of the woman that you play. I don't think she'd be listening to Liberace records in her room. I think she'd probably be listening to Elvis.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I think Liberace is better because of her disconnectedness to her sexual libido, you know, and I think Elvis, the pelvis, definitely is, I think, a little bit too raunchy for her. I think Liberace's a little more feet-off-the-ground kind of music for her, and I kind of agree with Mr. King on that, so I have to disagree with you, Terry.
But I see you've really thought it through.
Yeah.
Kathy Bates, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me. It was a pleasure.
Kathy Bates stars in the new film, Misery. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the resignation of Edward Shevardnadze?
Hi, Terry. Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze is indeed resigning, saying that his country wants to give too much power to President Gorbachev and that Gorbachev wants to take those powers. We'll have a report from NPR's Ann Cooper in Moscow and the State Department reaction from Ted Clark. A story from Panama about economic difficulties there continuing a year after the U.S. invasion. Letters from listeners who say that we should be asking this question these days about the Persian Gulf situation. What is worth killing for? A weather conversation with a rancher in South Dakota. And Bob Mondello reviews Mel Gibson in Hamlet.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the next couple of weeks, we're cutting some of our regular critics loose from their regular beats and sending them off in different directions. For instance, we asked jazz critic Kevin Whitehead for a review of the new movie, The Russia House.
Director Fred Skepsy's film, The Russia House, is based on John le Carré's 1988 book, which everyone calls the first post-Glasnost spy novel. The story's about ordinary folks who go behind their government's backs in order to further the cause of world peace, the perfect Christmas present. Sean Connery, who's wearing his best toupee ever, plays Barley Blair, an English publisher whose business takes him to Moscow. On one trip, he meets a Soviet rocket scientist with a secret. He's known as Dante and is played by Klaus Maria Brandauer.
Who are you, Dante? What do you do for a living?
I am a moral outcast.
Oh, it's always nice to meet a writer.
Ooh, good line. It's from the book. Dante is, in fact, a writer as well as a scientist and has written a blockbuster full of secrets so secret the Kremlin doesn't know them. It turns out that the Soviet missile program is a joke, which means the West isn't in nuclear peril. Dante wants Barley to publish the book, but British intelligence intercepts it, and publication is the last thing they have in mind. If everyone knows the Cold War is over, the spy masters will be looking at massive layoffs. Instead, they recruit Barley as an agent to find out if Dante's information is genuine. His contact in Moscow is Dante's friend Katia, played by Michelle Pfeiffer. Of course, Barley falls for her. She seems to be the only beautiful woman in Russia. But he can't tell her what he's really up to.
Are you a publisher?
Yes.
Are you a spy?
No.
Are you alone in this, or were you sent by others?
I'm alone. I'm alone, and that's the God's truth. Never been more alone.
So, Barley's in a pickle. Will he betray his Russian friends? Will he betray his country? We're talking crisis of conscience here. Le Carré's novels tend to be pretty brainy, and the movie prides itself on taking the high road. There are no squealing tires, no fistfights. I don't think there's a gun in the whole film. On the other hand, Tom Stoppard's screenplay rearranges elements of the plot to make it more of a star turn for Connery, and the filmmakers have stooped to adding a shamelessly manipulative ending. To tell you the truth, The Russia House has the look of a movie that got made because it could be made. The Russians really like the book, so they let Skepsi shoot in Moscow and Leningrad. It's nice to see those cities on screen, but Skepsi overdoes it. Barley and Katya are always meeting in incredibly picturesque places, and the camera has this nervous habit of always dollying up to windows and balconies to give you a look at the scenery outside. After a while, you have the feeling the actors are just getting in the way and you should be taking snapshots. Connery is always fun to watch, and Pfeiffer's accent doesn't slip. But The Russia House is neither really good nor really bad. It just sort of lays there. It plays a little too much like a travelogue with noble aspirations.
Kevin Whitehead's favorite movie this year was Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Fresh Air is directed by Chris Spurgeon. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a review of the year in politics from satirist Mark Allen Stamaty, creator of the comic strip Washington. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.